tell you that it's been an interesting week. We've got a week of classes under our belt, and it's very, very interesting. On the front row of my classroom is about 40 students. I have 8 kids on each row, so there's 8 students on the front row. 3 of those are women who were born and raised in Afghanistan. 2 of them, their folks have immigrated to the United States. 1, the parents are still in Afghanistan. And I got to talking to that one a little bit this week, and her goal is to go to medical school, become a doctor. And as she puts it, my mom and dad want to immigrate to the U.S. I want to go back to Afghanistan. I want to be a doctor to my people. It's going to be an interesting year. There's others in the class beyond. That's just the front row, and probably not even all of the front row. Okay, pop quiz. What was the lesson last week? You're off the hook. You weren't here. Okay. You're on the hook because you were here last week. Okay. What was the lesson last week? Lessons from lepers. Okay? I got to thinking about that, and I thought lepers are not the only ones in the Bible that might give us some lessons. And I realized that there's some things I want to talk about that we can learn from people who were kings. So this week is going to be lessons from kings. And I started thinking there might be some others along this line. So I'm planning that maybe for a little while we'll talk about lessons of that sort. Lessons from mothers and children, lessons from soldiers, lessons from farmers. I don't know where all it'll go, but we'll go for a while on that. But this week it's lessons from kings. Second part of the pop quiz, can you name the first 2 kings of Israel? In the Old Testament, who were the first 2 kings? Some of you can do this. Uh-oh, maybe none of you can do this. Saul, that's the first one. David was the second one. Many of you will know the first 2. Yeah, let him talk about it. A smaller number of you will know the next 2. And I need to warn you before you try to come up with an answer, there's actually 3 people that you have to name the next 2 kings. There's Solomon, very good. And after Solomon, the kingdom split. So now there's 2 kings. Those 2 kings are Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Okay?
You didn't even give me a chance to
answer. And what we want to do this morning is we want to talk about lessons that we can learn from these 3 kings. The lessons we're going to learn this week are negative lessons, not positive lessons. What not to do is what we're going to be focused on. Okay? Now, let me just set the stage for this for just a moment. If you'll look in 1 Samuel chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8, a few of you will remember that Samuel was a little boy who came and answered the prayer. When I talk about lessons from children and mothers, probably Samuel and his mother Hannah will be part of that subject matter. We'll learn more then, but we can get a little preview now. Hannah prayed and prayed and prayed that this child would be born, and her promise to God was, if you give me a son, I'll give him back to you. So after he was a few years old, she sent him back to the temple, and he worked for the priest. The priest was Eli. Eli was very old. His sons were about to take over the family business, and his sons were not very good. In fact, if you look at what the sons were doing, they're checking off most every box on a 12 or 15 box chart of all the things you shouldn't do if you're trying to be a priest. And so the people revolted about this, and that's what chapter 8 of 1 Samuel talks about. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges of Israel. His eldest son was called Joel, his second one Abijah. They were judges at Beersheba. His sons did not follow his example, but seduced by the love of money, took bribes and gave biased verdicts. Verse 4, the elders of Israel assembled, went back to Samuel and said, look, you're old, your sons are not following your example, give us a king to judge us just like the other nations. Now, to put that in larger context, when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, his message to them was, I want you to be a special people for me. I want you to be a kingdom of priests. And in essence, God was to be their king. So if you look just a verse or two later, verse 7 and 8, God says to Samuel, it's not you that they're rejecting me. the way that Kings came into the picture was as a rejection of God's leadership, and God recognized that. Saul didn't do very well. The kingdom was taken away from him and given to David, and then David was king. Now, what I want to do is I want to look at how the succession came from David to Solomon. This is in 1 Kings chapter 1. If you can find 1 Kings chapter 1, the first few words of verse 1, David was very old. Mine says King David was now a very old man. He even had trouble keeping himself warm, and they found a unique way to keep him warm. Jump down to verse 5, still in 1 Kings chapter 1. Adonijah, son of Haggith, this is one of David's wives, my translation says, was growing pretentious. What does your translation say at that spot? What words does your translation use? 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5. Adonijah, and it names his mother, put himself forward, one translation says. Exalted himself. Okay? He decided, David hasn't said he's going to be king, might as well be me. And so he sets himself up as king. Very pointedly, he avoids the people who are closest to David. But he gets everybody else, he gets them all together, they have a big banquet, and the banquet is a celebration of Adonijah taking over as king of Israel. Now, if you look in verse 8, it lists some of the people that he didn't confer with. The previous verses, he had talked about the ones he did. Verse 10, it repeats some of that and adds that he left off of all of his brothers, he left off Solomon. The verse that follows, Nathan goes to Solomon's mother, Bathsheba. We've heard her name before. We've heard Nathan's name before. What was his function? He was a prophet. Okay, he was a prophet who confronted David about the sin with Bathsheba. Nathan works with Bathsheba, and it's a little hard to figure out what's happening here. But if you read through this, it sounds like palace intrigue. They tell David that they speak to David as if they're reminding him that previously he had said Solomon was to be king. But as Robbie Zacharias, whom I'm stealing some of this from, pointed out, there's no record prior to this that was ever said to David. So maybe they've made that up. It's not real clear how the Bible record works. But in any event, they say to David, Adonijah is over there setting himself up as king. Is that what you meant to happen? Didn't you say Solomon was supposed to be king? So David has Solomon anointed as king. Adonijah finds out about it and runs for his life. That all falls apart, and Solomon is king. So he became king as a result of what looks like might have been palace intrigue, not a clean succession to the throne. Secondly, within a short period after that, Adonijah begins to do some things that are treasonous, and Solomon has him executed, which again is not the cleanest way to do that. Things are kind of ugly when you start executing a brother or a stepbrother. Now, many of you know what happened in Solomon's reign. The greatest wealth any king seems to have ever had, just great palatial stuff. But there was a price for that. And one of the prices for that was, almost as soon as Solomon died and the succession went to his son, that's Rehoboam, by the way, almost immediately the kingdom split. So whatever success Solomon may have had during the time of his reign, it didn't last, and it's hard to call that successful if it has not lasted. So something went wrong with Solomon as king, and we're going to try to see if we can find out what that is. All right? Now, let's turn to the succession to Rehoboam. And hold on a minute. You'll turn to 1 Kings. We're still in 1 Kings chapter 12. This time the succession was clear. Rehoboam was the choice, the eldest son. He was to be king. And so he went to Shechem. That was still the whole worship center had not been transferred completely over to the temple yet. The temple was still too new. And when he got there, the people were there to proclaim him as king. They're going to celebrate his ascension to the throne. But take a look at verse 4. There's a delegation of the leaders of the people who come to him, and they speak as follows. Now, I want to know what your translation says in here as well. I'm now moving into verse 4. Your father laid a cruel yoke on us. If you will lighten your father's cruel slavery, that's a pretty strong word, right? He has made us slaves. That heavy yoke which he imposed on us, if you will lighten that, then we are willing to serve you. And he said to them, go away for 3 days and come back to me. What is yours? Does yours use the word slavery in the middle of that verse? Or does it use some other term? Burdensome service. Any other words? Harsh labor. Okay? Now, Rehoboam, in that 3 days, consults. If you'll take a look in verse 6, talks about the first group he consults with. In verse 8, I think it is. Skim through there, you'll see it. There's the second group he consults with. Who does he consult with? First he consults with the elders, which means Solomon's advisors. And then, verse 8, he consults with the young men that he grew up with, the ones who were attendant on him. Did the two groups give the same advice? What did the elders say? Now, this is in verse 7. You may have to read it a time or two to see what they're saying. Do what the people ask you to do. That's the old, that's the elders. Okay? And what do the younger ones say? The younger ones say, pour it on. Make it worse. Now, let's pause for just a minute. How can the people of Israel say Solomon had us in slavery? How did that happen? Answer's not clear again. But I think most commentators, when they read this, will tell you something like this. It looks as if, in order to do all the glorious things that made his reign looked at as the one that's the most beautiful, the most glorious, he had to raise taxes. And if you raise taxes high enough and you can't pay the taxes, what are you going to do? And the answer in those days was, you sell your children into slavery, and maybe you sell yourselves into slavery. Indentured servitude, we might have called it in the early days of our country. But the phrases that are used in my translation are forced to labor, that's back in chapter 11, and cruel slavery, that's the word that's used in chapter 12. Okay? So the older people have said, people are right, lighten the burden. You can't make the whole nation slaves to just support a small number of people at the top. That's not a tenable way to have a country. The younger ones say, probably because they were benefiting from it, pour it on. You know what Rehoboam did? Take a guess. He poured it on. What the people did? Take a guess. They revolted and the kingdom split. Alright? Now we're going to take a look for a moment at Jeroboam. Because Jeroboam ends up as the king of that dissident group, of that split out group. If you'll take a look at verse 26 of chapter 11, you meet Jeroboam for the first time. It gives his name, Jeroboam, tells who his daddy was, Nebat, tells where he came from the section of the land called Ephraim, and from a particular city there, Zereda or Zereda. Says his mother was a widow, and it names her. And then it says at the end of verse 26, one quick summary of what was his story. What's that quick summary? End of verse 26. Mine says he was in Solomon's service. Does yours say that? Verse 26. 1 Kings 11. 1 Kings 11. We jumped over 1 Kings 11 to look at Rehoboam. Now we're back in 1 Kings 11 to look at Jeroboam. It said he was in the service of Solomon. But what? Rebelled, yours says, revolted, mine says. It does not say why he revolted. Did you pick up on that? It just said that he did. It doesn't say why he rebelled, just that he did. All right, so let's go to verse 27. This is the account of his revolt, it says. Solomon was building one of these palatial buildings. He was closing a breach in the city walls. And Jeroboam was, and it gives a word or phrase of description. By now we're in verse 28. What does your phrase say?
Mighty
A valiant warrior. What does yours say?
A man of standing
or of stature. Great courage. A mighty man of valor. Mine says a man of great energy. This is somebody who could get a lot done, and he could get a lot done in a lot of different arenas. So what did Solomon do? Verse 28 continues. Solomon, noticing how the young man set about his work, put him in charge of all of the forced labor for the house of Judah. That's Jerusalem and all the region around, all the stuff he was doing.
House of Judah.
Yours says Joseph. I'm sorry, mine says house of Joseph. But what that's talking about is that whole section of that. There's the word forced labor. Does yours echo that word?
Or something like that.
What's he just been done? Jeroboam is working like crazy on all these building projects that Solomon has going on. He's been put in charge of all of it, and he suddenly realizes he's a slave master. So that's probably part of it. But a little bit more comes along. A man of God, a prophet. And if you'll notice, he's got the same name as one of Eli's sons. It ain't the same person because we're a whole lot later in time. A lot of time has gone by. Ahijah accosted him on the road. And when he did, the conversation they have goes on to say, God has chosen you to be a king. He's going to split this kingdom, not in half. What's the proportions going to be? Roughly 1 to 10, or it's either 1/12 or 2/12, depending on whether you call it Benjamin and Judah or just Judah. But 2 of the provinces remain, and 10 of them are gone. Okay? And as they do so, you're going to be king of that other part. Solomon finds out about this. The combination of Jeroboam suddenly not being very happy about being a slave master, and secondly, he's starting to recognize, maybe I'm going to be the king after Solomon, at least a part of this country. If you were Solomon, what would you do? He's a threat to your son accessing to the throne. What are you going to do to him? This isn't hard. Squashing like a bug. Kill him. So Jeroboam runs for his life. He heads to Egypt. Okay? Now, in a parenthesis in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 12, this is what we jumped over. We read verse 1 and then we jumped to verse 4. In that parenthesis, it says, as soon as Jeroboam heard that Solomon had died, he was still in Egypt at the time, he returned. And so, when this group of people comes to Rehoboam, Jeroboam is actually leading the group. It's Jeroboam who says, if you will lighten the load, we will serve you. Isn't that cool? The kingdom is now split. Jeroboam has taken over half of it. Rehoboam gets an army together. But the word of the Lord came to a man of God who spoke to Rehoboam. This is verse 21, 22, 23. He's got this army together, but a man of God comes to him and says, don't do this. Don't fight against your brothers. And he has the army stand down, so the split is now made. Jeroboam's got his part, 10/12 maybe. Rehoboam's got his remnant, 1 or 2 parts, depending on how you count it. So what does Jeroboam do now? If you'll take a look at verse 26.
My translation says, he thought to himself, and then there's quotation marks. Does yours have something like that?
Okay, what did he think?
Mine says he said in his heart.
Said in his heart.
Probably even better. What do you say? Can you skim a verse or two and say?
They just built the temple in Jerusalem. All of my people are going to continue to go to Jerusalem to worship. My kingdom's not going to keep going. If I'm going to have my kingdom keep going, I've got to somehow break up my people going to Jerusalem to worship. So now read a verse or two more. What does he do? He sets up golden idols. Golden what? And what does he say to the people? Hear, O Israel, is your God, or here are your gods, who brought you out of Egypt. Whoa. Let's go back a bit. And you got to go back in your mind's eye. If you don't remember this, just take it. This is what happened. Moses goes up on the mountain to meet God after the children of Israel come out of Egypt. He's up on there getting the Ten Commandments written by the finger of God. The first of the Ten Commandments says, "You will have no other God before me." Meanwhile, back at the foot of the mountain, Aaron is calling all the people, "Give me all your gold." And when Moses gets back down, what does he find? A golden calf, and they're all worshiping. And Aaron says to Moses, when Moses says, "What in the world are you doing?" Aaron says, "I don't know, I just threw all this gold in the furnace and look at what came out." That is a quote. That's as close to a quote as I can get. "I just threw it in the furnace. Look at what came out." So setting up the calves is really an echo way back to that earlier time. Why did he make two of them? He made two so that he could put one right on the border between the end of his country. That was the northern country, so it's on the north-south border. He puts one there so that before the people get to Jerusalem, they've got a place to worship. They don't have to go any further. And then he puts another one way up in the far north. And he tells the people, "You want to worship? Here's the places to worship." And God's reaction is, "Oh my goodness, we can't have this, and Jeroboam's going to lose his kingdom." We now have three failures. Solomon's looked good for a long time. Economic power like the world has ever seen. Financial power like the world has ever seen. Splendor and glory for all the appearances. But it didn't even last a year past his death. Rehoboam, the leader of the opposition, has come to say, "If you'll just lighten the load, you basically sold the whole country into slavery. If you'll just lighten the load, we'll all serve you." And Rehoboam says, "No." And the split comes. And Jeroboam takes his people, sets up false worship, and God says, "No, we're not going to let you go that way either." All three are failures. What I want to do now for the time we have left is I want to look at each one in turn, and we're going to leave Solomon for last. There's a reason for this. It's because it's a little harder to see what was going on with Solomon. We're going to look at Rehoboam, we're going to look at Jeroboam, then we're going to look at Solomon, and ask ourselves, what went wrong? What is the heart of the problem? Lessons from kings. What not to do is what we're looking for. Fair enough? Any comments or questions before we begin?
The split was Judea and Israel.
Turn your hands the other way. Judah was the southern part where Jerusalem was, and Israel is the north part. Israel is what became Samaria. Eventually Jeroboam built the capital, or one of the kings built the capital city that they call Samaria, and that's where Samaria came from. This is the northern kingdom which became Samaria in Jesus' time. And this was where the split took place. Judah is called Judah because that's the main tribe that was remained. Benjamin, I think, stayed with them, but it was so small it just sort of gets included with the other one. That's why, is it 2 out of 12 or 1 out of 12? It's a little hard to say. But it's Jerusalem and Judah in the south. In Jesus' day, Judah was still identified in the south. Galilee was identified in the north. And Samaria was that big place in between. Okay?
Approximately how many years from the Moses calf to these calves?
500-700 years.
This history repeats itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, what was the problem with Rehoboam? What was the problem with Rehoboam?
He consulted with the elders and the peers, but not God.
Pretty good. He consulted with people, but not God. I didn't say that in the first hour. I wish I had. That's pretty good. I said something else. Yeah, he's looking for the answer he wanted. Yeah. Here's where I went. Any of you present in church on Wednesday night of this past week at 6:15 in the sanctuary? Was anybody present at that time? It was wonderful. Young adults in our church pouring their heart out, and I'm ashamed how few of them I knew. Pouring their heart out about how they wanted to reach the young adults in Chesterfield County and the surrounding areas. And the things that they thought had to happen in order for that to work. And one of the big ones was, we can't do it alone. We need to partner with the older folks in our church. And Shirley Freeland, who almost died, has a walker and can hardly get around. stood up and spoke of her vision of what could be, and the applause nearly shook the walls. It was exciting to be here. What did Rehoboam not do? I got to tell you, this part of the lesson is different from what I thought it was going to be last week as I was thinking towards today. He got the advice of the older folks. He got the advice of the younger folks. What did he never do? He never put them together. That's where I went, Teresa, when he talked about never consulted God. Boy, that's a good additional one to think. But what I said was, he never put them together. He never said to them, look, what are the goals you're trying to accomplish? And what? How does your advice take me there? Here's what they're saying. Here's what you're saying. Talk to each other. Let's see if we can work these things out. That's hard work. It's a whole lot easier to just stand there and make the call. Especially if you make the call that sort of makes you feel you're more in control. What hides behind someone who would listen to the advice that says, pour it on, make everybody more miserable than they were before, that's the way to run a country? Greed might be. Pride, more likely. Arrogance, a good synonym. I think if I were to talk about what the problem was with Rehoboam, it would be pride and arrogance. He's following Solomon, and the whole world has acknowledged Solomon has reached a level of grandeur and glory that no king has ever reached before. And Rehoboam says, you think you've seen it? I'll show you something. It's going to be even grander than that. And the bottom drops out. Move to Jeroboam. Let's move to Jeroboam. What's the problem there? And before we go any further, I want to show you something I've skipped over until now. There may be a couple of you in the room who've seen this before, but I think most of you will not have seen this before. Who were the first two kings? Saul and David. What did God say about David as he was replacing Saul with David? He said David was... Uh-oh. What did he say about David? God's judgment on David. A man after my own heart. And he said to David, I'm going to make your kingdom permanent. We understand that now that he saw Jesus coming in David's line. And he said, your throne is going to be established forever. Right? Okay. Now, 1 Kings 11, just in the middle, we looked at 1 Kings 11 and we looked at 26 and 27 and 28. And then we jump down to 40. Remember that? I want to go now to 37. This is the tail end of what that man of God said to Jeroboam. Man of God says to Jeroboam, God's going to make you a king. He's going to split the kingdom and you're going to get most of it. And here's what he said. Verse 37, I will appoint you to rule over as much of the country as you wish. You will be king of Israel. He said in verse 35 and 36, I'm going to leave a little bit because I promised David that he would have a kingdom for his lineage. But most of Israel I'm going to give to you. Now watch what happens in verse 38. Verse 38 is a very long verse. If you listen to all my orders and follow my ways, if you do what I regard as right, if you keep my laws and commandments as my servant David did, then I will be with you and I will build you as enduring a dynasty as the one I built for David. Had you ever heard that before? Ain't that something? Jeroboam has just been told, I will do everything for you that I did for David. Why did Jeroboam throw it all away? What could possibly have compelled him to do that?
Would be fearful that it was going to be taken away because the other one was going to Jerusalem to the temple.
Exactly. Fearful. This means he doesn't trust God to do what God said. God is not capable of doing this. I've got to do it myself. And the whole trust thing shifts. And what would make him do that? The ambition that said, I've got to do it myself because the outcome, the control. I think this one is ambition. I think Rehoboam is more pride and arrogance. There's probably ambition in both. There's probably pride and arrogance in both. But it seems like to me the table tilts a little more towards ambition for this one, a little more towards pride and arrogance for Rehoboam. Questions so far? That's an astounding thing God said to Jeroboam. I had not seen that. Ravi Zacharias talked about this. I'm stealing shamelessly from what Ravi Zacharias said. And I think Ravi is right. He said, there's some things I have not seen, and this is one of them. Okay? So now, yes, sir.
He's the prophet to speak to Jeroboam? Or was he the prophet?
He started off with a prophet to speak to him. Ahijah came to him in verses 28 through about 35, 36. What we just read, that was the prophet of God coming to him, right?
The prophet was telling him.
Uh-huh.
But then God told him himself.
Yeah. Uh-huh. God, it was the prophet speaking.
Okay.
This is what God says. God says, I will make you a dynasty equal to David's. Come to chapter 13. There came to Bethel at the Lord's command a man of God from Judah, just as Jeroboam was standing at the altar getting ready to offer sacrifice to one of those golden calves. And he stuck his finger out and said, what you're doing is wrong. Yeah, God said, men of God, to Jeroboam. At least those two times. Once at the front and once later. Questions so far? So what was the problem with Solomon?
When Solomon first became king, God said, tell me what you want. Tell me what I can do for you. What Solomon asked for?
Wisdom. And God said, I'll give you wisdom. Was Solomon wise? More wise than anybody else before or since, they say. So how could he have done so many stupid things? We're still in chapter 11, I hope. Chapter 11, chapter 12, chapter 13. We're just hanging right in here. I'm going out to a few other places to sort of get some context. Look at the first verse of chapter 11. And let's read a little bit. 1 Kings, chapter 11, verse 1. King Solomon loved many foreign women. Not just Pharaoh's daughter, but, and now the rest of these are plural, Moabites, plural, Edomites, plural, Scythians, plural, and Hittites, plural. From those people of whom the Lord had said to the Israelites, you are not to go among them, nor they among you, or they will be sure to sway your hearts to their own gods. But Solomon was deeply attached to them. How many wives of royal rank did he have? 700. How many mistresses did he have? 300. Busy boy. When Solomon grew old, verse 4 said, his wives swayed his heart to other gods, and his heart was not holy with the Lord his God as his father David sent him. He became a follower of Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, and of Milcom, the Ammonite abomination. One of these involved temple prostitution. You'd put prostitutes, male and female, and if you were male, you'd go consort with the female prostitute. If you were female, you'd go consort with the male prostitute, and you worshiped the fertility god by doing that. Milcah was the god that you tossed your children into a fire and burned them up to sacrifice to try to get the gods to do what you wanted them to do. He built the temple, right? But during his lifetime, the same person who built the temple, verse 7, he also built a place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the mountain to the east of Jerusalem, and to Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Don't go there, but just mark down. If you want to walk over sometime to 2 Kings chapter 23 and read the chapter, a later king called Joash decided to clean out the temple, and as they cleaned out the temple, they found the book of the law, and nobody knew what it was. And they finally found, oh my goodness, isn't this interesting, a woman prophetess. She's the only one in the kingdom who knew what it was. And she explained to the king what it was. He tore his robes, went into mourning, and the whole place turned back to God. And in the process, they cleaned out the temple. In that chapter is a list of all the things they cleaned out, many of which were put in place by Solomon, including male and female prostitutes inside the temple he built during Solomon's lifetime. Those were put in place. That's in 2 Kings chapter 23. How bad was it? It was awful. So along with everything else, along with Solomon's glory, There was also this cancer, this rot at the middle of it that was just unbelievable. And the question is, why? It's not simple enough to blame it on the women. You don't get to do that. It's more subtle than that. If he was so wise, how could he be so stupid? If you think you're the smartest guy in the room, who do you listen to? If most of the time you are the smartest guy in the room, who do you listen to? It was very significant what you said about Jeroboam. Didn't God ever send somebody to talk to him? Here's what Ravi Zacharias said. He said, I don't know what the problem was, but I'll tell you, I think I've got a hint. He is the only king that I see in the whole record of the kings, all the way through until the Ninevites took away some of them and Babylonia took away the rest of them. He's the only king for whom there was no prophet speaking to him. Jeroboam had these men of God come to him and say, what are you doing? It didn't work for Jeroboam. It did work for David. And that's the difference between David and Jeroboam. Whatever Jeroboam was, God saw promise in him. Way more promise than I had ever realized. Zacharias is right about that one. That is a huge, significant verse. And then when you look, God is sending people to Jeroboam. It's almost unthinkable that God wouldn't have sent people to Solomon. But the Bible record has no record of any conversations actually taking place. And he says, I think what happened was in all the privilege, in all the things that Solomon was doing, which also would include pride and ambition, there was never a prophetic voice. So, where do problems come when Christians try to live a Christian life? If pride and arrogance come in instead of humility and dependence, problems come. That's a lesson we can learn from the king. When we start trying to accomplish things that we think we're doing in God's name, if we don't trust God for how those things go, we're going to be in big trouble. If we try to take over and say, well, we're going to do them our way, we're going to be in big trouble. And most of all, if there's nobody in our lives that has the position to be able to put a finger in our face and say, you're going the wrong direction, you better watch out, we are really in trouble. Those young people on Wednesday night said, we need the wisdom that the older people have here. We live, many of us, so far from our children's grandparents. We need somebody who'd be foster grandparents to our children. My own son-in-law, who's standing up front with this group, told a story I had never heard. If he talked about this, I don't remember it. He said, when he first came into this church, I remember that. He married Kathy, then moved here. They were living here in Richmond. They came into this church, and his first reaction was, this place is way too big. We're going to go find another church. And that was fine with us. We said, that's okay. But he stayed. And I found out Wednesday night part of the reason was a wonderful woman by the name of Norma Hamlet invited him and Kathy out for supper. Come to our house and eat supper. He said, that's been 15 years, and I still remember that dinner. That's part of what anchored me in this church. And then he started naming all the other people that he had interacted with. Tom Murphy and I forget all the others he named. Sunday school leaders. And these young adults in our church were saying, we want to reach the young adults around us. There's thousands of them within just a few miles of our church. We want to try to get them to where they know the Lord too. But we cannot do it alone. We need your help. Part of that help, we need somebody to take care of our kids while we're trying to work on doing this. But we also need wisdom. We need to work together. And it was a call for a change in the way some things are done. And as I was listening to this, I'm realizing that last thing with Solomon. Are we giving each other, are we giving somebody the right to point a finger in our face and say, you're playing with some dangerous stuff here, you need to go in another direction? Are we getting so full of pride that we think we can just do what we need to do any way we see it? And we got to the point where the things we're trying to accomplish, we think God's really not capable of doing that. I've got to do those things. If any of those start to creep in, we're in trouble. But if we can put the opposite in, the humility, working with God, whatever resources he gives us, and most importantly, giving other people the right to look at what we do, the transparency, and to say, that's not the right direction. Then we've got a chance. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Father, we thank you for the time you give us. We thank you for these hard questions to wrestle with. We thank you for the examples we have given. We start to realize that there are wonderful, powerful, able people like Jeroboam in our life, in our world today. But they're not always effective for you because they sometimes have a fatal flaw. There are people with such worldly wisdom, but they haven't added to that the spiritual wisdom of consulting you and consulting people who understand who you are. And we know that there are people like Rehoboam, capable of such wonderful things, but they just listen to the wrong people, and they never listen to you, or they never have the people who advise them get together to sort out the differences. Teach us the better way. Teach us how to live for you in the way that gives you glory and honor, for we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.